London Stanley Centre at 6.
Truly tremendous. In fact, so tremendous, I officially declare today, the 11th of November, Fuzzbox Day. Yes, we went into the news. We went into the news, as you know, with that classic scenario of international rescue, which is what the news needs. And they come out of the news with pink sunshine. And it gets even better, Eva. It gets even better, Emma, because online now, who might we have?
Do we have the lovely Vix?
The amazingly lovely Vix, indeed, and her mischiefs. Vix from Pink Sunray.
What an entrance.
Hey, I like that, having an official, like a national official day. That sounds great.
It's the way forward.
Yeah,
you know?
We definitely need to make this happen.
I still cherish my Fuzzbox album from the day. Exactly. Yeah,
you haven't put it in the bargain basement.
No, on vinyl and everything. And as I said to the legend that is Tony McDonough from, of course, Manila PR, and he said, what would you like to feature Vix and her mischiefs? I said, it was only a few weeks ago where we featured International Rescue because it was the 50th anniversary of Thunderbirds and we wanted to be a bit different.
Of course.
You see?
Oh,
yeah.
And fancy them not using our theme tune for the show. I mean, how disgraceful.
Frankly, Vix, you're absolutely right.
I mean, thank you, though.
In fact, I will get on the phone to Jamie Anderson forthwith.
Yes, we'll make a complaint.
Right. Yes. Do it.
So we will, in fact, yeah, we will stick to that. But fame has moved on. It's like a driver. And what a wonderful thing for the midweek drive to have fame is your driver. It's all fitting together. It's
good
destiny.
Links. I like it.
Exactly.
A little tenuous, but I like it anyway.
As Emma's just sort of inquired, does this mean that Fuzzbox are no more? I said I don't think so, because I'm sure there's a cameo appearance in the video of a little white box with Fuzz written on it.
That's my hairdresser. What a naughty boy he was as well. He didn't tell me anything about that.
What?
Suddenly sneaks out of his pocket on a Vix and her Mischief video shoot. What a cheeky thing. But, right, what's happened is, I mean, Fuzzbox haven't done anything for some years. We had a bit of a reunion in 2010, and then that was that. And I've been having my fantastic band, Vix and Her Mischief, which is kind of more Americana, another all-girl band. And it's been brilliant. We've had some really amazing festivals and stuff this year, and we did a really successful Pledge Music campaign where you raise funds through crowdfunding. So we're recording a new EP now. And then we did this video as well for Fame Is Your Driver, the single at the moment, which is just brilliant. It's got so many, you know, friends and fans.
It is quite literally, Vix, probably one of the best videos I've ever seen. And I don't say that. It's, you know, so, you know,
that's a top review.
And you know, obviously, we wouldn't necessarily turn around and say, as you're listening to radio, check out the video as well, unless it's safe and legal to do so, because I'd hate to have people driving around thinking, let's just watch this. If you say do that, we'll do it in the studio. We'll work our exactly. It's important. Vix, if you'd be kind enough to stay with us, and would you like to formally introduce the tune which really, if he's got any sense whatsoever, Simon Cowell should actually have as the theme tune to every Britain's Got Talent programme he ever runs, you know, X Factor, etc. Would you like to give the full introduction to Fame Is Your Driver? Vix, over to you.
This is the fantastic single by Vix and Her Mischief, and it's Fame Is Your Driver.
Your 15 minutes fame starts right here, so enjoy it while it lasts and while we live. Will you save or sell your soul in the name of rock and roll? Some say that it's the price of fame, my dear. If fame is your driver, you're likely to crash. You're going to burn out, you're going too fast. If fame is your driver, you'll get to the top. Pull over, please stop. I wanna get off, I wanna get off. Your 15 minutes fame is flying by. It's so hard to know just where to draw the line. Bearing more than you should, much more than you thought you would. Come on, show me yours and I will show you mine. If fame is your driver, you're likely to crash. You're going to burn out, you're going too fast. If fame is your driver, you'll get to the top. Pull over, please stop, I wanna get off, I wanna get off. Your 15 minutes fame ends right now. they built you up overnight, then tore you down. Check into rehab and sell your story, revealed in all your glory. You'll be tomorrow's trash anyhow. If fame is your driver, you're likely to crash. You're going to burn out, you're going too fast. If fame is your driver, you'll get to the top. Pull over, please stop, I wanna get off. I wanna get off. Pull over, please stop, I wanna get off. I wanna get off, I wanna get off.
I think that deserves a round of applause. Go!
Yay!
Sensational.
Oh,
and
you.
Did you see the fuzz box?
I did indeed. I saw the cheeky cameo there.
Exactly.
Loved it.
I know. It was lovely. We had lots of little cameo roles in it. And it's so nice because it's so kind of diverse and inclusive, and I'm all into that. So it's really brilliant. We had some Fuzzbox fans in as well and stuff. So.
And let's face it, who's not a Fuzzbox fan? I will say, you might be listening to this, our director colleague in Los Angeles, and in case you're wondering, Phil Dennis will be back with us next week, of course. He's taking a brief hiatus this time around. But Phil Dennis actually has a cat called Fuzz Aldrin. I think, you know, you might call it Fuzz Aldrin, but for me, I feel that it's probably an homage. An homage to, of course.
Bound to be, even though he's avoided me tonight.
Yeah, well, it's his loss. That's all I can say this. His loss. Eva, questions for Vix?
Oh, I don't know.
You had asked me about the Fuzzbox thing as well. Fuzzbox, that we've just reformed and auditioned some other members to make up the rest of Fuzzbox. We haven't got any more. So Maggie and I are still the original members.
Excellent.
And then we've got some amazing new girls on guitar, drums and bass. They're absolutely brilliant. And the rehearsals have been really fun, and it's really rocking. So we've got our London show this Friday.
It's almost enough to make us come down straight away to see you. I know. It's only 126 miles away after all. We need to sort of work our way through that. Emma, from your own perspective.
Yeah, well, you said you had some crowdfunding for one of your tracks there. What's it like knowing that you've got such great fan support?
Oh, it was really lovely, actually. It was something like 116%. I think it went up too. I mean, it's still kind of there. It's just we don't promote it anymore because when we made 100%, we were quite happy. So it was really nice. It's fun putting it together because you can have any idea. So, you know, as a band, you come up with the ideas. Like, there's lots of merch, T-shirts, and some of it are exclusive. And then there's things like you could book a house gig or signed lyrics or set lists or photos, singing lessons with me. I mean, it was really, really diverse. Stuff. And they pledge the money, and then obviously they get a treat and something exclusive, and we get to, you know, pour some money into recording and promoting and videos.
It's just a virtuous circle of happiness.
Oh, lovely.
That's the good thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you've got your Americana, you've got your country, you've got your rockabilly, you've got everything you would wish for in terms of the 21st century, which we have arrived in. It's fantastic. Vix, anybody who can play the ukulele and deliver tunes which are bitingly satirical on the current state of affairs with Simon Cowell, clearly, as I say, if he's got any sense, he'll use that as the theme to any of the sort of shows that he's actually involved with. Because astonishingly, actually, neither Eva nor Emma were necessarily born when Fuzzbox first made it.
Right.
I know, it's astounding. It is quite, you know, I could scarce believe it myself, but, you know.
But I was barely. I was a babe in arms.
Very true, exactly. But in terms of, I mean, it was the start. I mean, obviously, there was Bananarama. We had, dare I say it, Toto Coelho, I Eat Cannibals. Oh Lord above.
Great.
Exactly. Most people have said exactly. And then, of course, Fuzzbox, or to utilise your full title, We've Got a Fuzzbox, and we're going to use it.
And indeed we did.
Exactly, exactly. And do you think it's easier slightly now with respect to new bands coming on board? I mean, if you're giving advice as Vix and Her Mischief's available from that point of view, would you say, yeah, just go for it? Because, I mean, Emma will confirm, we regularly feature up-and-coming bands. And,
yes, we do.
Well, it's great because there's, I think, you know, you've got more kind of control over what you do. You have to manage yourself, promote yourself a lot more, you know. Mm. A lot of it's more homegrown, which is quite nice in a way, because as I say, you control it and you can kind of decide everything that you know you want to put out musically and artwork and so on. But it's almost like it's a much bigger ocean, you know, with a lot more fish in it. So it's got pros and cons. I mean, obviously, bands like Bananarama weren't sort of bands in the same, well, groups weren't. They weren't bands.
They didn't play the ukulele, Vix. Let's face it, they did not play the ukulele.
Play any flummy.
Exactly, precisely. Siobhan, so, Sarah. I mean, if it wasn't for that Terry Hall, where would they have been? Let's be honest.
But Fuzzbox are still the UK's most successful all-girl band. Mm. And this is one of the like reasons why Maggie and I feel really passionate about getting out and still kind of... We still feel we've got a mission, really. We want to get more female musicians out there, more female bands. You know, it isn't easy to find a lot of female musicians, but they are out there, and I really wish they'd pick up a few more guitars. And
well, you should meet one of our regulars, Tallulah Rendell, who's one of our sort of regulars. She does some cracking stuff, etc. And indeed, of course, Lindsay Gold, who's a songstress who we've featured earlier in the press. So we all work together. A reminder that live at Magic Garden, the debut EP for Vix and Her Mischiefs will be available very soon. In fact, it might be available.
Oh, it's out.
It's out there. Now. It's already there. Exactly.
Fame
is your driver, of course, available in every sense of the word from that perspective. And it's just more wonderful. And is there a website? Of course there is. It's vix.uk.com.
That's it, VIX.com. Exactly. Plus, of course, Twitter and Facebook and Reverb.
You're everywhere.
Blah, blah, blah. Yes, you've got to be, haven't you?
It's just one magical thing after another, quite frankly. Vix, it's been a privilege and a delight, almost unparalleled.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Vix's little online home. Exactly.
Home.
Is that group hug? And there, you see, Fuzzbox are back. Yay!
Yeah, it's all good. What's our go.
So, in fact, I think we'll probably wrap up with that. I think we only had a sort of clip to the news. I think we'll have a slightly fuller version to take us round to our cosplay correspondent, Gwyneth Griffiths from Newcastle upon Tyne. And we've been speaking to Dawn King, who's the director, indeed writer and adapter of the latest incarnation of Brave New World. From Brian Aldersax, I should say. There we are, a different line there. But Vix, we have two final questions to put to your good self. First of all,
gosh, perfect.
I know. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme this evening?
The answer to question number one is absolutely busting.
Nice.
That's, how's that?
Yeah,
I like
yeah,
it.
Very
that's
good.
A good
well up there.
Well, give me the next one.
Can we look forward to featuring you again in the very near future, maybe this side of Christmas, to keep us appraised of how things are going?
Yeah, we've got some Christmas shows locally, particularly, which are very fun. So, yeah, definitely. Yes, go on then. Why not?
Vix will return with the why not? A exactly. A round of applause for Vix, please.
And for yourself.
Oh, no. Thunderbirds Argo. And we'll take the Pearl and Dean cut, I think, for this, which is an interesting variant. Yeah, I thought we'd go for a little satellite. You know, Vix, anybody who can come out with an album title which goes, look at the hits on that, has got to be, you know, a classic scenario.
Oh, God. That was nothing to do with me.
I didn't think so.
No.
But it was,
oh, God.
But it made me smile. It made me smile.
Oh,
anyway.
It made me smile. Anyway.
Life continues. This is the Pearl and Dean remix of International Rescue.
Thanks a lot, guys. Catch you soon. Bye. International Rescue.
such creatures int, as Shakespeare once said in The Tempest, which, of course, served as the template for Forbidden Planet, amongst others. In fact, in many ways, arguably Shakespeare's full version of science fiction. But back in 1932, the text Brave New World emerged, written, of course, by Aldous Huxley. But the sort of moment that we've been waiting for across the ages and the times-based has clearly arrived with respect to the tour of Brave New World, a co-production between the Royal and Derrigut and Turing Consortium Theatre Company, adapted from the novel by Aldous Huxley, by the legendary writer that is Dawn King. Dawn, welcome to the programme. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, thanks.
Excellent. So this tour, which obviously kicked off back in September and goes until the 5th of December, heading around into a variety of routines, welcome to the future. Genetic engineering, it didn't just start with Crick and Watson or indeed with Mendel. This was really a take on society and a dystopian society, we might well say, that still echoes today in the year of our Ford 632.
Yeah, I think when I read the novel prior to doing the adaptation, I was very surprised by how many things Huxley had kind of thought of, which have kind of either come true or maybe are about to come true. I mean, he kind of created the Feely cinema, which was a kind of forerunner of virtual reality. And obviously he also kind of, he was talking about babies being kind of manipulated in bottles. It was sort of before genetic engineering, but that's essentially what he was talking about.
And there is this classic line that it sort of addresses the author's fears that in his own concept, an intoxicating cocktail of rampant consumerism, permissive sex and gratuitous entertainment was reducing humanity to a race of selfish and easily controlled infants concerned only about the here and now. He could almost have been predicting the Facebook generation, couldn't he?
Yeah, in fact, I just need to go and check Facebook right now. Actually.
Yeah, well, there you are. You see, like,
yeah, totally. I mean, I really felt that it was, the book was kind of talking to me about my life. I mean, it's very much about a kind of cosmopolitan population that just is constantly distracted with one thing or another, and people who are solely defined by their role as consumers in society, which I feel is kind of very much how we live really now.
In terms of the actual production, it started off, of course, in Northampton, which is an interesting place to start in all sorts of ways, and then moved up to Edinburgh, off to Oxford, of course, Nottingham, as featured in early October, then Cheltenham recently, and, of course, Wolverhampton, Darlington, Blackpool, Bradford still to come, of course. How's the tour been going? I suspect standing ovations are around the country, really.
It's been going really well. I think everybody's been really pleased, and what we've had as well is lots of young people coming, which we're really happy about.
Well, it is certainly something which ties in with my own students at the University of Lincoln, where we run a science fiction module for both the English Level 3 students and indeed the film and television studies students. And this is something which, you know, we talk about that part of the 20th century, obviously 20, 30 years after H.G. Wells had kind of had, I mean, arguably his heyday. We know he still had H.G. Wells' Things to Come that was emerging in the film industry and so on. But Huxley probably joining in cinematically Fritz Lang's Metropolis, the concern, arguably as well, even Wells' view about the future and his concern about the traveller in the time machine, where he goes forward to a future which is society has split in two. And really that's the essence of science fiction, really. It's speculative fiction, almost science philosophy.
Yeah. I think that Huxley definitely saw himself as a philosopher. In fact, he kind of talked about himself as being a philosopher who used the form of the novel to discuss his ideas. And I think Brave New World is so fantastic, and it's also such a challenge for an adaptation because it's got so many ideas in it, and it also has a lot of plot, so lots of things happen, which was kind of amazing for me, but also, you know, it was tough.
To quote from your very own words, Dawn, adapting this huge work for the stage has been as tough and stimulating as anything I've ever done, and a huge pleasure.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it really was.
When the concept first came up, did you kind of have to take a sharp intake of breath and say, okay, then let's go to it. After all, I am the Dawn King.
I don't know about that. I mean, my agent kind of called me and said, something's come up and you're going to say no because you're too busy. And I said, what is it? She said, it's Brave New World. And I said, well, I have to do it, obviously. And just by chance, the stars so aligned that actually some space kind of arrived in my schedule just in time just kind of purely by chance. I didn't know that that was going to happen. So I was more or less able to kind of dedicate 8 months continuously, pretty much, to Brave New World, which was a huge privilege and really, really unusual, I think, to be able to kind of do that. So I kind of really immersed myself in Huxley and in the science and in all, you know, all of that stuff. And I read loads of other books that he'd written, and I read books about him, and I read stuff about eugenics, and, you know, just kind of really went, I just went for it. amazing.
That makes the whole thing sort of perfectly sorted through on that basis. The cast as well, we have to give a couple of mentions to this cast, because as well as obviously James Dacre, who directs the production, you've got Sophie Ward, who's got a wealth of experience, obviously, for a variety of things, from Young Sherlock, Land Girls, Heartbeaten, and so on. Abigail McKern, of course, Olivia Morgan, William Postlethwaite. So I mean, it must be advantageous to know that, in essence, you've got a good, safe pair of hands collectively to actually ensure that the production is going to work.
Yeah, I mean, we were very lucky because we ended up with a cast. I think it's very unusual that you would say that there's not a single weak link in the show in terms of the cast. They're all really amazing, and they give so much. I mean, if you go to see the show, we've got 10 actors, and I think they play like 200 parts between them. So they're always doing something. They're either they're on stage or they're backstage, they're changing costume, they're about to come back on, you know. So they've become like a really, really kind of close team. And I think we did really well to get them, and I'm pleased to have met them all, and I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to work with them all again in the future.
Well, I'm sure the reverse will be the situation. They'll want to work with you, Dawn. That's the important thing. Or as the strapline goes, I don't want comfort, I want danger, I want freedom, I want sin. Interesting perception from that point of view. As we look at the design of the set, I mean, obviously Naomi Dawson responsible for the set design. I mean, my initial thought was this is a very ambitious thing to actually put on stage. But then, of course, if you can put Chitty Chitty Bang Bang on stage, anything's possible, really. So from that perspective, did you think that, does it add something actually seeing this theatrical incarnation and adaptation of the text itself?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there are things in the book which you can't do literally on stage. So you can't go to a factory and see 90 sets of identical twins or, you know...
I was going to ask about that. I thought that could be an interesting one, really.
So what we've done is we're doing theatre, so we're not showing literally these things. So we're kind of showing, you know, there's a lot of movement, and there's amazing music, which has obviously been composed by these New Puritans, which is just astounding, and it kind of does a lot of work in terms of the atmosphere and the mood of the show. And we've got a lot of video design, we've got lighting, and so all of that stuff together is kind of creating, you know, it's not literal, that's kind of the beauty of theatre, and the audience is kind of doing some of the work. You know, we've got some amazing movement with our movement director, Eddie Kay. Yeah, and I think that that's one of the reasons why it's so exciting.
Absolutely sensational. And Darlington is privileged to actually sort of host this fantastic production, obviously, between the 10th of November through to, in fact, it's on now until the 14th of November. Next week, of course, you can check out the Black Bull Grand Theatre, the 24th to the 28th of November. And then, of course, it wraps up, as we said, at the Bradford Alhambra Theatre between Tuesday the 1st and Saturday the 5th of December. You can use the Twitter hashtag BraveNewWorld2015. That's hashtag BraveNewWorld2015. Or indeed the Facebook / Touring Consortium / Theatre Cloud, which is all wondrous in its own sort of way to be followed, etc. Dawn, it's been wondrous connecting with your good self, and thanks certainly to Arabella for finally managing to put us together and get this thing coordinated in all sorts of ways. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today? Has it been okay for you?
Yes, it's been great. Thanks very much.
Very important. So customer satisfaction, you know, it's a whole new aspect of the 21st century. So can we look forward to hopefully connecting with you again and keeping us appraised of all manner of marvellous Dawn King things that you actually put together? In fact, do you have a web address yourself you'd like to promote as well?
It's dawn/king.co.uk.
There you are, dawn/king.co.uk. Fantastic. Dawn, will you return?
I will, yes, definitely.
Excellent. So, Brave New World, Emma, is it the sort of production you'd like to go and see? Have you read the book?
I haven't, actually. It sounds really interesting, though. The adaptation...
Radio!
Theatre
adaptation sounds very interesting as well, so it'd be...
Theatre adaptation of Metropolis, that would be an interesting thing to
see.
Whoa,
that would be, you know, so high-tech.
It may happen, of course, and there was the Giorgio Moroder musical version of Metropolis, which we can look through as well. Eva, Brave New World?
Yeah, I've not read the book or anything, but
I'll give it a go.
Excellent stuff. Well, switching trains slightly, to use a transport metaphor, on the Midrick Drive, where it's currently 25 and a half minutes past 6 o'clock, we're going to food historian and broadcaster Saren Evans-Charrington. Apparently, 93% of British folk surveyed by Harvester Restaurants say that modern restaurant food is too trendy for its own good and admit they'd prefer a return to the good old days of simple, honest food cooked well. Any thoughts, Emma?
I mean, I wasn't very aware that restaurants had changed that much.
Well,
I know there's a lot of there's a lot. Perhaps there's more chain restaurants now than there used to be. But I don't think the food or style
fits in. As we'll see this next piece, as we said with William Sitwell, that his latest book is going to be on the healthy diet of rationing in the Second World War. One of Britain's biggest food trends, i.e. this no-fuss meals made by using traditional cooking methods, is being powered by technology that was developed at the start of the Second World War, specifically the Torrey kiln. Say that again, because you'll hear it several times during the course of the next interview. The Torrey Kiln. And we'll find out about these thoughts from Harvester Restaurants' Joe Hudson and food historian and broadcaster Saren Evans-Charrington after this. That clearly echoes across the centuries, really, and probably none more so than when you're referring to food. And with a recent survey by Harvester Restaurants demonstrating that an overwhelming 93% of British folk say that modern restaurant food is far too trendy for its own good, and it would be much better to return to the good old days of simple, honest food cooked well, we're delighted to be able to welcome to the Midrick Drive today the legendary food historian and broadcaster extraordinaire, of whom even William Sitwell is probably in awe, if he admits it, on a weekly basis. That would be Saren Evans-Charrington. How are you, Saren?
I'm very well. I like my introduction. Can I have that every morning?
Well, of course, Saren. No worries whatsoever. And we've also got from Harvester Restaurants the wonderful Joe Hudson. Good morning, Joe.
Morning.
Saren, if we can come to you to start off with, I mean, it would seem that is there a kind of kickback against all of the fancy, arty-farty scenarios that come through? You think, oh, drizzle this, drizzle that, etc. Let's just eat the food. Let's keep it simple.
You know, it's a saying I've been saying for years, actually. And I think where this starts from is we start off in our food history with really good, wholesome food. You know, it doesn't matter what it looks like on the plate. It doesn't matter what it's in, as long as it's wholesome and it tastes good. And that's what food is all about, really, isn't it? Food is about sharing. Food is about good nutritional balance. And it's about getting good, wholesome food inside of you. It shouldn't be whether we've got a drizzle in the right place or a sprig of this or a dressing of that. But it became like that. And I think it all started after the Second World War. We come through the war. We have rationing ends in 1954. Quite frankly, we are fed up to the back teeth of having wholesome food. We're fed up of making do. We're fed up of having to use cheap cuts, you know, use techniques that make our foods go further or make them taste better or whatever, eke the rations out. And so we decide, right, we're going to have whatever food we want, plenty of it. And, you know, actually, let's forget about it being wholesome and good. Let's go with a bit of frivolity and a bit of silliness. And we start doing things sort of in the late 50s, 60s, like, you know, setting things into jellies and aspic and things like that, which is an old tradition. But, you know, things like, you know, oh, let's get a tin of Heinz tomato soup and pop it in some gelatin and, you know, use that as a salad ring, or let's do all other silly things like that, you know, like stuff an avocado with something. And so we go down the idea of, you know, sort of food that is sort of more about the style of it than it is about the substance. What happens from there is we then start going more into continental ideas in the 70s. You know, we want foreign food, things that are a bit exotic, you know, foreign travel's taken off, so we want that type of thing. 80s, we start getting into wanting the salads and our dressings and our side salads start coming in, and all of that idea comes in. And then the 90s, we really start, you know, we've got to have a balsamic drizzle with everything. And a glaze and this and that. And I think actually we just got a bit tired of it. And we just said, actually, what are we doing with this food? Are we going to hang it on the wall or are we going to eat it? I think that's where we're at now.
And of course, so. We do have that health factor. I mean, we mentioned our regular weekly correspondent, William Sitwell. He's working on a book which effectively is going back to the Second World War rationing and actually claiming it's a far healthier diet. And from what you just said there, actually that would seem to echo that ultimately, yes, we've had all these trends. We had obviously the onset of food fusion that developed. And of course the shift in popular tastes and so on. I tend to blame the French in certain instances as well for pressurising us in this country to actually go elsewhere.
But do you know, going the way through history, we have had an obsession with following the French cuisine.
Exactly.
So I think we can rightly blame them. Why not?
Indeed. But you know, from the sort of general perspective that we're looking for, one would suggest that actually it is important. I mean, particularly if we look at sort of the trends and you know, without mentioning obesity in its full sort of scenario, clearly there are issues to be had from keeping it simple, keeping it basic. I mean, if I can bring in Joe at this particular point, your average customer at Harvester, from that perspective, and clearly you know, they'll have their own sort of likings and so on, do they prefer the kind of more basic, wholesome, tasty food?
I think what we're finding is our customers actually like to have choice. So they like to have fresh food, quality food, and the choice to be able to decide how much or how little of something they want to actually have and serve themselves. And I think in terms of quality as well, I think that's much more of a, you know, it's more about the quality of the product. So the quality of the fish, the quality of the meat. And that's what we're also seeing. And I think there's also this trend towards more sort of barbecue or smoked flavours. We're certainly seeing that with our sort of push at the moment. And our sort of, it's just flying out the doors, really, the smoked pork ribs and things like pulled pork as well. So,
well,
I think,
I've often said if pork ribs could fly, it's a different world entirely.
Yes, yeah, there's.
it does. I mean, and this, of course,
going to comedy.
Yeah. We do our best, as many of my students say. From the point of view of technology, of course, I mean, you mentioned pork ribs, brisket, etc. The Torrey kiln in Scotland, pre-war, of course, 1939, pre-Second World War, etc. That would seem, Saren, from the technological perspective, to have been a game changer.
It was really. I mean, it's a brilliant development. And it's interesting actually to see it going into a modern usage. You know, I mean, I understand that there's been a few refinements in the techniques, you know, because technology is advanced. But it's interesting to see somebody like Harvester, you know, sort of going back and actually looking at history and using a technique that was used back, you know, in 1939. It's certainly that, you know, things like the pork ribs, the brisket, the pulled pork and things like that are now on these restaurant menus that, you know, are obviously sort of, should we say, driving restaurant trends at the moment in Britain, would have been impossible without this invention. And I think that's the thing. If it's a good idea and if it tastes good, it never really truly goes out of fashion. It just goes on a cycle, you know, and so things sort of we move away from and eventually we move back to it. And so we have moved back to things like smoked meats, you know, smoked fishes, things like that. And we're also moving back towards other traditional dishes, you know, like the sort of the rich suet puddings, using offal, using cheap cuts, you know, all of that type of thing. It's all coming back into fashion. And I think the reason is that it was actually essentially a really simple, good idea. And certainly, you know, the Torrey kiln, smoking meat is a simple technique. It doesn't require lots of fancy ingredients going into it. It is just basically enhancing the natural flavour of the meat. That's all it's doing. I mean, originally used as preservation technique, but now we don't use it for that. We're using it for the flavour that it imparts. And I think that that's why it will actually remain as a popular food trend. I predict that this will become one of our iconic foods that we actually retain. You know, smoked meats will come back in.
I know this is probably slightly off beam, but in terms of our vegetarian or vegan listeners, they're probably certainly saying, we don't. Would you say from a vegetarian point of view, that's also something which, again, you're looking at wholesome materials and aspects within that as well?
Absolutely. I mean, smoked cheeses and things, actually. I had a go at building a home smoker, actually. It's a cold smoker, and I actually did smoked cheese, and fantastic, you know. And actually, the reason I did it was I didn't want, you know, smoke flavouring in anything. I wanted actually to see how I could take a good piece of cheddar and you know, see what I could impart flavour wise. So that was brilliant. Had a few mishaps on my way, I have to say, with it, but eventually I cracked the technique. So there you go. But no, in terms of vegetarianism and things, exactly the same. I mean, actually, one of the things is, if we go back to, you know, Second World War, we were eating, because we were on ration, we were eating less meat than ever. We were having lots of vegetarian dishes. We were actually the healthiest we've ever been. And then, you know, we move forward after the war, we suddenly increased the meat intake. I think with the way that things are at the moment with economics, that's why we're looking at cheaper cuts of meat and you know, actually things like sharing platters, things like that, things that we can share as a family. Because I think people are actually now looking at their budgets and looking at how they can reduce the costs of what they're eating.
Indeed, and don't get me started on processed foods, because that's another line entirely. Saren, that is quite clearly why not only are you an ace food historian, you are a food historian extraordinaire. And indeed, lots of things to talk about. Indeed, we can also go back to the medieval period. But time is against us as ever, so I need to ask both the fine folk, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme this morning? Has it been okay for you ladies?
It's been wonderful. Thank you. It's been a delight to talk to you.
It really has. Thank you
very much. Jo, this is the critical kind of customer service routine. You know this with Harvester restaurants. It's always important to get that feedback. So the next critical thing is, can we look forward to featuring you again in the not-too-distant future and keeping us appraised of food trends and more in the 21st century?
Yeah, you certainly can indeed. Yeah,
you can
indeed. We'll be back.
Well, thank heavens for that. Saren Evans-Charrington, food historian and broadcaster, of course, and Jo Hudson from Harvester Restaurants, recorded earlier today. Just a little update from Penny Evans, actually, who has stepped into the breach that Phil Leonis normally would do at this particular stage. She's listening to the show. She loved the Giorgio Moroder version of Metropolis. Well, of course, I haven't screened that because we went for the original and best earlier today, Emma. Some might say that. We'll find out in a few seconds. But in addition to that, Penny is having difficulty listening to the show in Derbyshire because the wind keeps knocking her offline.
Blustery day.
I mean, hopefully the wind isn't knocking our ace sequential narrative soul and lead writer for Starburst magazine, Ed Fortune, offline. Is the wind okay where you are, Ed?
It's very windy in Manchester, and of course it's very rainy in Manchester. The beaten tower is beating a drum as per usual, but we're safely ensconced in Starburst towers.
It's like a kind of, you know, if the place in the event of a zombie apocalypse you wanted to actually go, then clearly Starburst Towers in Manchester. Soon, in 2016, we will visit, hopefully. I mean, I think that is the invitation still there for us, Ed, to visit as a location?
Absolutely. And also spend your time at the Fab Cafe whilst you're there.
The Fat Cat?
That sounds fabulous.
The Fab Cafe, sorry, it's the Fab Cafe, not the Fat Cafe. It's very confusing there. We'd be, of course, the Fab Cafe, I'm sure, would be in Saren. Saren Evans Charrington's Good Food Guide, I'm sure, because it would be there.
Well, you can get a pangalactic goggle blaster there, and all sorts of other randomly sci-fi foods, though. Precisely. I'm always a bit partial myself to Warren Ellis's Transmetropolitan and the weird nano foods, which are made out of bizarre and wacky things, and the very suspicious chain of restaurants called Long Pig.
Yeah, you see, that's the sort of thing that your friend would probably have difficulty with, Emma, because if they're not used to anything that other... I mean, if a pizza is the height of their explorations of non-British food, they might find that that could be a step too far.
That's a bit extreme.
Welcome back to the show, Ed. As always, a delight to connect with your good self. Need to head off with a plug, obviously, for the current edition of Starburst magazine, which features Katniss Everdeen on the front cover.
Ooh, lovely.
We can find out tomorrow morning what our ace cinema critic, Philip Richard Fitzwilliam, made of part two of the trilogy. It also has to be said, hats off, Ed, to a superb recommendation, not only this month with respect to the Captain Scarlet box set of DVDs,
worth getting for a Christmas present in any way, shape or form. But also, for last month, where he also gave a particularly large thumbs up to the official autobiography of Captain James T. Kirk, which time had prevented us from actually sort of covering. So, well done then as well. In fact, you know, we've almost learnt that an Ed Fortune review is quite literally worth its weight in gold.
It is.
In fact, Ed, we might ask you to actually sort of cast your ear over Vixen and the Mischief's latest number so that Fuzzbox, who are back, yes, we've got a Fuzzbox and we're going to use it. Yeah, featured earlier in the show. Fame is your driver. If they get the Ed Fortune seal approval, it's it, you know. Easy
that really did kick me back, I must admit. That took me back a long... I think it was one of the very first pieces of vinyl I ever purchased. That and Kenny Everett's It's Not That.
Exactly.
And Musical Youth, of course.
Kelvin, come back with the apple pie. Sorry, I just can't. Musical Youth, you know, past the Duchy from the left-hand side. Very important. We will play some for you, Eva. It's the sort of thing that your musical college at the Royal College of Music in Manchester will benefit from if you actually did some Musical Youth in the audition.
Oh, okay.
he says with tongue slightly in cheek there. It has to be said. Anyway, back to Star Wars magazine. One little minor point, though. It has to be said that, the magazine is in my office, and that's about 4 or 5 minutes away from the studio.
We haven't
exactly, so it's in there. It's all the excitement of Metropolis and other things. But I was very taken with the fact that there is almost civil war breaking out in the letters pages of Starburst. Yeah.
How so?
One correspondent was actually described by the letter writer as a vile man. A vile man. This necessity has obviously got the editor, Jordan. It was like nuclear war. I mean, I thought the pages were going to incinerate in my fingers as I was reading them. It was that
the
level.
Passion,
it was
the anger.
Can't we all just be friends?
Jordan delivers some spectacular rants. He actually, I will shamelessly plug his own radio show, which is on Fab Radio this evening, where he will normally rant about something, but I think if someone says something quite negative like that letter does about one of our regular correspondents, never mind Paul Mount, he's going to respond firmly.
Respond. It was a nuclear button response. It was a cut and half.
A loyal response.
Oh my lord! I mean, I was almost tempted to actually say to our other good friend and colleague, also Richard Edwards from the other magazine SFX, and they've had a few sort of Barneys in their sort of analysis pages. This one, well, it has to be said, it certainly is a talking point. It has to be said, Ed.
That is true. We are, I think, the only genre magazine that still does a letters page, and the letters page has to be, shall we say, lively, to prove its worth and its value, because it's so easy to just go on Facebook or to go on Twitter and get that kind of instant gratification. Whereas there is something to be said for writing a letter, getting it published, and then, you know, zap kapow, a month later, there's a huge... I mean, we also had the ongoing Belgian drama where one person from Belgium was like, I can't find any other sci-fi people. And then we had a whole list of letters from people who read the magazine who happen to be in Belgium, and a whole thing about Jean-Claude Van Damme, which I still don't understand.
Well, the whole thing is, and we were tempted to raise this with Fien Heel, our Belgian correspondent, earlier, is if they're not cycling all over the country, you know, covering thousands of miles of kilometres, looking for fellow sci-fi fans, you know, they just need to lift their heads up a little bit.
Yeah.
They're out there.
They're everywhere.
If you're in Belgium,
quiet, maybe.
Exactly. It's important. We didn't actually ask you to bring any food back from Belgium. That's a different line entirely. Moving on to clearly the world's longest running magazine of cult entertainment. And overall, quite a good year, really, Ed, I think, in terms of genre stuff. I mean, we were talking today about the second of our particular movie series. It's a mini movie series that we've actually had, completely free, offered to the public, as well as obviously students at the University of Lincoln, kind of follow on from Telefantasy and Society. Last week, of course, Emma, we screened
Logan's Run, which was very interesting, actually. Yep. Very 70s as well.
And there is a companion podcast to go along with that, where you actually have a movie specialist or filmmaker. In the case of Logan's Run, it was Phil Leonis. In the case of Metropolis today, it was Dean Haglund from The X-Files, who either have a passion about the movie or they just want to share some thoughts about the whole thing. And so today, it was indeed
Dean Haglund, wasn't it?
And Metropolis.
And Metropolis.
Exactly. So the Metropolis number might be worthwhile connecting. Have you seen either of those movies, Ed? I mean, I realise that might be a bit ridiculous. I thought that would be a response. You know, it's, you knew it was a bit of a left field question when if you'd responded with the lines, never heard of them ever in my life, I would thought, are you really the Ed Fortune then? From lead writer for Starburst magazine?
To be honest, they're both anti-utopian movies that I adore, and they're also very much product of their time and of their age, and they reflect the fears of that age. Brings us back to what you were saying earlier in the show, of Brave New World. And there's a reason why my column for books is called Brave New World.
I thought you'd pick up on that. That's why I asked you to listen to the show. Fantastic. Go for it. Indeed. I mean, again, that literary sort of side of things. And you can always say, I mean, at times, Huxley was also anti-American as well as anti-consumerism, really, or worried about it, shall we say.
I think it's very much, I mean, visionary is a word that's bandied around an awful lot, but it's very much a visionary work. I would say it's less paranoia than a series of legitimate concerns exaggerated for parody. But, of course, there is that thing where, you know, parody can quite, Poor's Law, can quite frequently reflect reality over time. Mm. It's, you know, just how we are built as people.
I think the point about Metropolis, I mean, Emma and I were talking afterwards about when you see, obviously, as close to the original as we've received so far, without the benefit of a time machine, being able to actually go back and see the Fritz Lang movie that actually almost bankrupts German film industry. I think it was the water that probably did for it in the end. It's probably all that water.
All the water.
That's right.
And paying all those children to be in a movie.
But the tragedy and the poignant thing was, how many of those individuals would have actually made it through the Second World War? Would have actually still been alive?
Yeah.
I mean, we know, obviously, Fritz Lang's wife became a Nazi whilst he went off to America to sort things. He sort of went through that. It's quite, as you said, Ed, very much of its time, but also quite poignant as well. Heaven knows what they're going to make of H.G. Wells' Things to Come, as directed by Alexander Korda, that comes up in a few weeks' time.
That is also an interest, because it's an interesting movie. It's an interesting work as well. But I very much see that you have a theme of the past looking towards the future. But then, of course, science fiction is never about the future. Which is an old line and an old gag. Because, of course, it is. But, of course, it isn't at the same time. It's about...
Well, heads exploding already. It isn't. Oh, no. Does not compute. It's like a robot. The other movies, in case you're interested, I want to sort of follow through on this, are indeed next week, 2001, A Space Odyssey, followed by Dark Star. Thought that was a nice little combination there. Yeah.
Lovely.
And then we conclude just ahead of the end of the term with Forbidden Planet.
Very exciting.
So, I mean, there were so many others. I mean, and when we're thinking about another mini series next term, where we'll be looking at probably Planet of the Apes, Gattaca, the perspective taken from Silent Green, of course, is also in there as a likelihood from that point. And who knows? Maybe it. Do you know, Silent Running probably will emerge in terms of that. We kind of thought we'd go green with Silent Green. But, you know, we thought, no, actually, Silent Running is certainly there, not only for the Doug Trumbull scenario, but also because of the Joan Baez tunes as well. So, yes, wondrous stuff there. And I say, hopefully we'll be recording. In fact, we get the thoughts of Ilana Rain, our director, on the latest podcast, which is Things to Come, assuming our technology works. Emma, moving on, what would you like to find out from Ed Fortune, the Fortune Meister, who is just...
The Fortune Meister.
He is.
That's a pretty good title.
Fortune Meister.
So, Ed, what would you recommend readers flick to first in the latest edition of Starburst magazine?
If you're going to go for episodes, you should, of course, be listening to the podcasts, the Bookworm and Starburst podcasts, which are online on the website.
Of course,
but
multimedia.
The latest issue of the magazine, I'm always going to say Wolf Damage, but really you should read the letters page and just keep paging through. It's built to flip through. Recommending one particular article is grossly unfair to my fellow contributors, and also it's designed to draw you in. Unlike the other magazines that are out there, we have much a broader appeal and much more depth as well.
Brilliant.
Kind of will always hit you. So read the entire thing is what I'm saying.
Of course.
I was supposed to say, Emma, you were quite taken with the Bond issue that I passed. If only for the article, which kind of gave the Reeves story behind Josh Trank's abomination with Fantastic Four.
Yeah. I mean,
Shocking.
The less we talk about that film, the better.
The likelihood of Josh Trank's Fantastic Four appearing on one of the Culture Shapers series that we're running here, it's very remote. Very, very remote.
Such a disappointment. But I think I've already said on the show in the past that the Fantastic Four movie has been made. It just happens to be called The Incredibles.
Of course. Yeah, no, I agree. And what a great movie that is.
It's directed by Brad Bird. What a name.
Brad Bird. I didn't have high hopes for the film when it came out because I'd heard so much on social media, all the controversy that was going on.
On the plus side, it did enable me to get a complete fifth stamp on my Showcase Cinemas card, so I was unable to actually go and see two movies free of charge after that. So that was a win.
That's the highlight.
On that basis, the others were Ant-Man, which is okay from that point of view. Jurassic World, which again, solid from that point of view. And I think there were a couple of Mission Impossible was also in there, Rogue Nation, and another one which was emerging at the same sort of time. So, it got my stamp on that. So loyalty card worked.
I think with the Fantastic Four, if they ever try it again, someone needs to have a word and say, what you
please
need is a Doctor...
Several.
What you need is you make a Doctor Doom movie. Make the Doctor Doom movie, and then bring in the Fantastic Four. That's how you start, because the most interesting character there are the villains.
Yeah.
The family is
and
family.
Miles Teller is not Reed Richards. I'm sorry, it's just the casting just so... And neither is Jamie Bell. I mean, we did our... Jamie Bell did his first ever interview with our sister station back in the North when he was just... He got the news as Billy Elliot and so on. That was, so he's a good bloke. He's all right. But he's not Ben Grimm. Sorry.
I mean, just the thought of Billy Elliot being the thing.
Please. You're going way out there.
You've got to stop using the Ultimate Fantastic Four as a pitch document. The Ultimate Fantastic Four is wonderful as an introduction for the fans, but as an introduction for a filmmaker, you've got to go Josh Kirby all the way.
There you have it. As indeed you have with the Captain Scarlet DVD box set, which is available, and obviously great news that is around and sorted through, because it features Lieutenant Green, Cy Grant, and of course Edward Bishop, as Adam Svensson. The other name for Captain Blue, and of course the very own Paul Metcalf, who is the alter ego for Captain Scarlet, proving that he was actually a British superhero, alter ego, identity, sense of thumb. We could go on, but I'm going to ask you another little quick question, which is privileged to actually be offered to the person who wraps up the show. And normally this is Phil Leonis, and Phil, you will be back,
miss
don't
him.
Worry. But every so often it's good to... He was ill last week.
Have a
so
bit of variety.
Exactly. So would you like to select a number, please, Ed, between number 2 and number 27, please?
5.
Number 5.
Ooh, going low.
This is what the universe has to say for you.
Before this odyssey ever began, there was you, your best friends, and wide-eyed curiosity among you about who would be the first to leap, the first to forget, the first to kiss, the first to tell, the first to fall, the first to get back up, and the first to remember that it all began with a dare to love in spite of it all. Is that you, Murgatroyd? I remember the glint in your eyes, all three of them, the universe.
It's always nice to finish a show with a three-eyed Murgatroyd. I feel it sort of makes it all sit together so perfectly. Eva's nodding.
Quite I am, yes.
I see on the latest StarburstMagazine.com site, Nicole Kidman in talks for Wonder Woman. Michael Stuhlberg joins Marvel's Doctor Strange. And you've got popular fantasy author Neil Gaiman with 4 of his short stories adapted for a TV series.
Fingers crossed.
Lots of good things to sort through there. Plus, of course, the podcast. I must admit, I've never been able to quite locate the Starburst podcast. I know they're out there. I've seen it. But in terms of actually listening to them live, Fab Radio. And they're on this evening as well. We'll talk.
FabRadioInternational.com, or if you go onto the Starburst website and select podcasts, they're on there.
Okay, well, we're on the website. I'm sure it'll be there and it will sort through and we will stick with that. Honest, we will. But it remains for Emma to throw those last two questions to you. So, Emma, take it away, please.
Yes, Ed, have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us on the programme this evening?
It's always a pleasure.
Oh, wonderful. And will you be joining us again on the show anytime soon?
Absolutely, if you'll have me.
See, this is where, you see, the Stone Tapes, which actually gets an airing tomorrow, remember it's our zombie special with David J. Howe and Sam Stone, they normally used to, for the first six volumes of that, featured Robin Pierce. But then Robin got another job working in a museum somewhere, so he's no longer around. So that means that Ed is quite clearly, you know, the Starburst contributor. Not only is he ace sequential sequential storytelling.
It's a sequential art editor, but it's a really polite way of just saying comic book guy.
And lead writer, Starburst magazine. He's also a Midwick Drivette. That's the key thing. Thanks to Cameron Tilbury, Peter Franklin, Fien Heel, Sam Stone, David J. Howe, Vix, from Vix and the Mischiefs, of course, and, of course, Dawn King, and Saren Evans-Charrington and Joe Hudson. And thank you, Eva MacDonald. Have you enjoyed the programme?
I have, yes, thank you.
Back next week?
Indeed.
And Emma?
I have also, and I will be back next week.
Excellent. And to you, Ed Fortune, a delight as ever. Can we also, and to you, dear listener, you know this to say, wonderful stuff. Great news coming in from Siren 107.3 FM. Unless you want to make the sensible decision and go, obviously, to Starburst and Fab Radio, Fab Radio International. There, I've said it. It's too late now. It's been uttered. I've said the word. Can we all say goodbye? A one, two, three.
Bye.
Bye.